Once again, I need to start today's lesson time with a PG-13 warning. Some of the material that we'll go over today is of a nature that you may not want to talk with your younger kids about or have them hear our conversation today. So you'll want to get them busy in another room or perhaps just turn the program off today and pick it up in another fashion later. But I want to just give you a heads up that I will be treating this stuff with my usual frankness, but still try to be as polite as possible. And you will need to be accountable and responsible for what your own children hear today. Okay, so let's go ahead and open to Deuteronomy chapter 23. Remember that the book of Deuteronomy is Moses' final address to the people, going over all the material of the law, because he knows soon he will be dying and they will be going into the promised land without him. So he's trying to jam as much review in as possible before he goes and dies on Mount Pisgah. So a lot of material. It jumps back and forth between different things. Sometimes we have related material close to one another. I almost picture Moses maybe going over some notes that he's jotted down, or maybe it's a free thinking process, or possibly people are engaging him, asking him about certain things as he's talking. So chapter 23, verse 1. We're going to talk about who is allowed to come inside the boundaries of the tabernacle, or later into the inner court, the worship area of the temple. Verse 1 says, "No one whose testicles are crushed or whose male organ is cut off shall enter the assembly of he who is." Now, the most obvious people that would be impacted on this would be priests and Levites, who would spend all of their time near the tabernacle working inside the boundaries that we're talking about here of the assembly of he who is. So if they have some sort of issue with their sex organ, an accident happens, or some sort of disease takes away something in their body, then they can no longer go inside those boundaries, and that would end their service. But other Israelis of other tribes would have to stay outside the boundaries if they fall into this category. Anyone that is a eunuch, whether they were forced into that situation through maybe slavery or some other authority figure telling them that they had to be castrated, or if they voluntarily did this, they could not come inside the boundaries. Now, I keep talking about these boundaries because I'm thinking more of the New Testament framing of this. In the temple, particularly the renovation by Herod, there was this boundary fence, we would call it, or parapet, that went around the base of the steps leading up to the shrine building and the worship courtyard immediately in front of it. And only Israelis who were healthy and whole were allowed to go beyond that perimeter fence. And definitely Gentiles had to stay outside of that area. What we refer to as the court of the Gentiles was outside of that boundary. Paul makes this into an illustration of how Jesus broke down the dividing wall by his atoning death, the dividing wall between Jews and Gentiles. And I always find that interesting that he chose to use that illustration. But in this case, no one with this issue in their body allowed beyond that boundary. Verse number 2, still on the topic of that boundary, but now talking about other reasons why you couldn't cross. "No one born of a forbidden union may enter the assembly of he who is, even to the 10th generation. None of his descendants may enter the assembly of he who is." Now, what do we mean, somebody born of a forbidden union? More than likely, what we're talking about here is a female Israeli knowingly marrying someone that worships a different god or goddess, somebody from another ethnic group that worships a god or goddess, or we flip the gender, a male Israeli who knowingly marries someone that worships another god or goddess. The children born in that marriage have not been devoted 100% to the true and living God. Therefore, they are not allowed to go beyond that boundary because they are not Jewish by this technical standard that is being applied here, because they have at least one parent that is not a practicing Jew. They would have to wait 10 generations of practicing proper Jewish procedures before any member of their family could go beyond that boundary marker. And so what does this do? It has a chilling effect on Israelis thinking that it's not that big of a deal to marry outside my faith. Because the moment you do, you doom your children for 10 generations from being able to come in to the special part of the worship area known as the Assembly of Israel. Verse number 3, still kind of on that same topic. No Ammonite or Moabite may enter the assembly of he who is, even to the 10th generation. None of them may enter the assembly of he who is forever, because they did not meet you with bread and with water on the way when you came out of Egypt, and because they hired against you Balaam the son of Beor from Pethor of Mesopotamia to curse you. But he who is your God would not listen to Balaam. Instead, he who is your God turned the curse into a blessing for you, because he who is your God loved you. You shall not seek their peace or their prosperity all your days forever. So the Moabites and the Ammonites, the descendants of Lot through his incestuous, drunken relationship with his daughters, they are so far afield from proper worship to God in this context, and they even opposed and tried to wipe out the Israelis, that they are not allowed to come into this worship assembly of Israel until 10 generations of proper worship procedure has taken place. Now, immediately, some of you that are longer-term students, you're going to go, wait a second, Ruth was a Moabitess. She was the great-grandma of David, and therefore the great-great-grandma of Solomon. And Solomon went into the temple complex, and so did David. Well, not the temple, but the tabernacle complex. And so how does that happen? Because he is a descendant, they are descendants of a Moabite. Well, you have to keep in mind that in this time period, your ethnicity was determined by your paternity, not your maternity. So it was who your dad was that determined who you were as far as your ethnicity. So Ruth did not make her children Moabites. Instead, Ruth's husband, Boaz, made their children Israelis, Judeans to be more specific. And so that's why this rule does not apply in David's family. Now on to another related one. Verse 7, you shall not abhor an Edomite, for he is your brother. Remember, the Edomites are the descendants of Edom, or otherwise known as Esau, the brother of Jacob, otherwise known as Israel. So that's why they're referred to as a brother nation. So Edomites are not to be treated in the same way that the Moabites and Ammonites are. because they're not as bad in their rejection of the true and living God. You shall not abhor an Egyptian because you were a sojourner in his land. So you need to think about Egyptians being someone that you had a relationship with in the past. And remember, this group that he's addressing here, some of them in the oldest tier, the ones that are in their 50s, the ones that are in their upper 40s, they would have remembered life in Egypt. And so Moses is saying, don't forget that connection. And when you come across Egyptian people, to take that in consideration. And then this is the application. Children born to them in the third generation may enter the assembly of he who is. So instead of 10 generations, now we see 3 generations. And we have a biblical character that this would have applied to, and that is Herod the Great. Herod was, by his ethnicity, an Edomite. We talk about him being an Idumean, which is just a slight variation on the term Edom or Edomite. More than likely, his grandfather, or probably his great-grandfather, was converted to Judaism long before Herod was ever born. And he is either the third or possibly just the second generation within his family that were raised, born and raised under Jewish law. And so I suspect he might have been the third generation, which means there was no problem with him being able to walk within the boundaries of the temple complex that we're having described here. And most certainly, his children and grandchildren, which we meet in the pages of the New Testament, had zero problems of walking inside the boundaries of the temple court of Israel, because they were past this 3-generation limit that Scripture puts on the Edomites. Let's jump to another topic now. When you are encamped against your enemies, verse 9 says, then you shall keep yourselves from every evil thing. Meaning, when you're taking the booty, the leftover things after the battle, you don't take stuff that is inappropriate, such as little idols, little shrines and trinkets that are devoted to other gods and goddesses. Those are not to be kept by the Israelis because, well, the big warning was you might start worshiping those gods and goddesses. So don't do it. There's an interesting incident in the time of Judas Maccabee, the hero of Hanukkah for the Israeli people. We're talking about in the 2nd century B.C., Judas and his men had been very successful before they went on their military raids and their military fights. They would pray and worship and devote themselves to God. And so they had really good protective responses. But on one occasion, they lost several men, and it shocked them that God had not protected these men. Until they started processing the dead bodies, and still until they started accounting for the burial of these dead soldiers. And they discovered underneath their armor, underneath their robes, that they had little idols, little trinkets, perhaps that they'd kept as souvenirs from earlier attacks. And every last one of these dead guys had these little tokens of idolatry on them. And so Judas and the others made the assumption this is why they were killed, is because they did not follow the rule of not keeping evil things of the enemy on your person. And so at that time, funerals were held, and they prayed to God to please forgive these men for their, I would say, stupidity, their inappropriate behavior, because otherwise they seem to have engaged in righteous behavior, even in the battles. So just a little interesting connection to this particular verse in Deuteronomy 23:9. Jump to another one. If any man among you becomes unclean because of a nocturnal emission. So the guy has this natural process that happens in his body, and he ejects semen in his sleep. Well, then he shall go outside the camp. He shall not come inside the camp, but when evening comes, he shall bathe himself in water, and as the sun sets, he may come inside the camp. This is part of a whole list of things elsewhere in the books of Moses that could count you as unclean ceremonially. It's not a matter of hygiene that we're talking about here. It's a matter of blood and blood products, and semen was counted as a blood product. So blood and blood products made you ceremonially off limits, or as the text says, unclean, for a period of time. So this is just a reminder that even when there is no sexual activity involved, other than what happened in a dream or what happened to your body in the middle of the night, that is still a blood product that the Israelis needed to show special regard for by going into a place where people go through the cleansing process. Verse number 12. Change topic. You shall have a place outside the camp, and you shall go out to it. And you shall have a trowel with your tools, and when you sit down outside, you shall dig a hole with it and turn back and cover up your excrement. Because he who is your God walks in the midst of your camp to deliver you and to give you your enemies before you. Therefore, your camp must be holy so that he may not see anything indecent among you and turn away from you. So what's this talking about? It's talking about you just don't poop anywhere you want to. I mean, that's as blatant as I can be, as simple as I can be. The Israelis were supposed to designate specific places just outside the boundaries of their encampment, within reasonable walking distance, that you could go to and relieve your bowels. And the way that you would do it is you'd have a tool and you would dig the hole. You'd go to the bathroom, cover the hole up, and go back to the encampment after you've done all the ceremonial washing that you're supposed to do. Now, this is very pragmatic sanitation. When any of us go camping, we know that if there are not basic facilities, that we're supposed to think about where we're going to go, because we don't want it to impact negatively upon fresh water and things of that nature. When you have outdoor toilets, and I grew up in a place that still had lots of outdoor toilets, you always were careful in picking the site where your outdoor toilet was, because you did not want it washing down into your well. You'd have to keep it away from there. And so that's all that the Israelis are being told here, is think about where you have your excrement going, because that's important. Verse number 15, change of topic. You shall not give up to his master a slave who has escaped from his master to you. Now, this is different than what we've been talking before about indebted slaves. Even amongst the Israelis, you could go into slavery over your indebtedness, and you would have to serve your master for 6 years, or at least as many of the six-year cycle as you had left in front of you. And if you ran away, they would bring you back because you owed the debt. So this is not that. This is talking about someone who has come to the Israelis from another country, from another place where they have been held as slaves. Maybe not just simply for indebtedness. It may be that these guys are slaves just because of who they are and ethnicity, like the Israelis were. Remember, the Israelis were enslaved as an ethnic group, not because they owed anything, but just because they weren't Egyptian. So this verse, verse 15, is all about having sympathy toward those who have been forced into slavery when they shouldn't be slaves. And so it's a fugitive slave law, different than the fugitive slave law that we have in the United States, or had in the United States, that actually precipitated some of the problems that led to the Civil War. That fugitive slave law was basically, even if you're in a free state, you have to send any slaves that come into your state from other southern states back to that southern state. And that was not appropriate. And so that's what the Israelis are told here, is if you have that type of slave show up in Israel, verse 16, he shall dwell with you in your midst, in the place that he shall choose within one of your towns, wherever it suits him, you shall not wrong him. So basically, do not send him back from the place he escaped from. Keep in mind, he is actually in the same boat that you guys, you Israelis, were being kept as ethnic slaves in Egypt when that was not right. Verse number 17, change of topic again. None of the daughters of Israel shall be a cult prostitute. They did have such a thing as cult prostitutes, where basically pagan worship rites allowed you to sleep with a substitute for your god or your goddess. So pay a little fee and you get to sleep with the representation of Aphrodite, or in the case of men, a male prostitute, which comes up next. None of the men or none of the sons of Israel shall be a cult prostitute. If you came in and you wanted to sleep with Zeus or Apollo, so you'd pay the fee, and a male prostitute from that temple would allow you to have sex with them. And so the Israelis were told, you don't have anything to do with that. None of that. That's not appropriate use of sexual activity. And then verse 18, take it one step further. You shall not bring the fee of a prostitute or the wages of a dog, which is a reference to a male prostitute. And I'm going to just try to explain it as carefully as I can here. It's a reference to the idea that the male in a homosexual relationship that is receiving the action acts like a dog and gets down on all fours, okay? And so it's not just that you could be a female and pay a male prostitute to have sex with you on behalf of a god. You could be a male that paid a male prostitute to have sex with you on behalf of the god. And so the next thing in verse 18 was, you're not supposed to bring the wages that you earn as a prostitute or a male prostitute, a dog, into the house of he who is your God in payment of any vow, for both of these are an abomination to he who is your God. So if the activity is illicit prostitution, then the pay of that is illicit and should not be given to the work of the Lord, because you're earning it by doing sinful things. And that sort of principle can probably be applied to many activities. Next topic, verse 19. You shall not charge interest on loans to your brother, interest on money, interest on food, interest on anything that is lent for interest. Now, this goes back to the idea of if you as an Israeli have a fellow Israeli that falls in hard times and they need assistance and you have the wherewithal to help them out, then you give them that assistance without charging them for it. Yes, they might want to pay you back over time, which is perfectly fine. That's even probably helpful to their ego to be able to pay back that assistance. But you, as an Israeli, helping another Israeli out during a rough time, are not supposed to make money off them. That's not fair. It's not right. Now, verse 20 says you may charge a foreigner interest, because this is talking more about a business deal. But you may not charge your brother interest, that he who is your God may bless you in all you undertake in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. So it's just another reminder, you need to be absolutely fair and considerate in your interactions with your fellow Israelis, because you're all in this together. And honestly, that is a good principle to apply within the church, within Christianity. We're all in this together. And we should not be trying to scam our fellow brothers and sisters. We should not be trying to make money, illicit money off of our brothers and sisters, especially those that have fallen on hard times. That is not right, to take advantage of their tough situation just to line our pockets. So we've run out of time for the day. So I hope you're finding a lot of this helpful in setting some principles as we're going through the history of the Israeli legal system.